I've seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on men. God gives a man wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing his heart desires. But God does not enable him to enjoy them, and a stranger enjoys them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil.
Walter Brueggemann is a provocative commentator on the Bible and on Christianity. And he wrote this: "The majority of the world's resources pour into the United States. And as we Americans grow wealthier and wealthier, money is becoming a kind of narcotic for us. We hardly notice our own prosperity or the poverty of so many others. The great contradiction is that we have more and more money and less generosity." Robert Werthenau, sociologist of religion at Princeton University, has studied stewardship in the church, and he's discovered that preachers do a good job of promoting stewardship. They study it, think about it, explain it well, but folks do not get it. Though many of us are well-intentioned, we have invested our lives in consumerism. We have a love affair with more, and we will never have enough. Consumerism is not simply a marketing strategy. It has become a demonic spiritual force among us. And the theological question facing us is whether the gospel has the power to help us withstand it. He continues, "We who are now the richest nation are today's main coveters. We never feel that we have enough. We have to have more and more. And this insatiable desire destroys us." Well, Brueggemann's evaluation of Americans is scathing. But it's hard to argue with him, isn't it? And the Bible supports his observations as a trait of human nature. Millennia ago, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10, "Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income." Aware of this temptation, Jesus warned in Luke chapter 12 and verse 15, "Watch out! Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." If people from third world countries came to your house or to mine, they would think that our lives do consist of the abundance of our possessions, wouldn't they? The question is, what is enough? Bailey McBride wrote this 2 years ago in the Christian Chronicle. "I am drowning in my stuff. Like a persistently rising tide, stuff happens and keeps my life endlessly complicated. It is entirely my fault. I cannot bring myself to throw anything away except the daily newspapers and two weekly news magazines that I read to have a balanced view of the world. National Geographic is another story. I have every one that has ever arrived in the mail. Issues for the last 4 or 5 years are in a 5-foot stack in my home office. Earlier issues spill over into the family workroom and the attic. I'm a book lover and have been ever since college. Even though I have contributed thousands of volumes to the college library, I have not one inch of space on any of the many shelves in our family workroom, my home office, the family room bookcases, my faculty office, or the large storage closet. I never have paid much attention to my clothes. They just seem to accumulate. Lately, the shirts in my closet are so crowded, I can't get one out without messing up several others. I gradually have gotten rid of all of the souvenir shirts and sweatshirts I collected on vacations and other travels. I've sorted out all those I can't remember wearing and am determined to buy no more. Still, the stuff is all around. Do you relate uncomfortably to those comments? I certainly do. In Exodus chapter 16 and verses 1 through 30, the Israelites cried out in the desert to God for bread and meat. So God sent manna from heaven, which they could bake into bread. He would provide enough for everyone, except for the sixth day of the week, when they were to gather twice as much. They were to gather only enough for each day. Otherwise, what they gathered extra would rot. God was teaching his people that if they obeyed him, they could trust him to provide them with enough. And so, in Leviticus chapter 25 and verses 18 through 22, as God is giving directions to Israel through Moses, he says, "Follow my decrees and be careful to obey my laws, and you will live safely in the land. Then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live there in safety. You may ask, what will we eat in the seventh year if we do not plant or harvest our crops? I will send you such a blessing in the sixth year that the land will yield enough for 3 years. While you plant during the eighth year, you will eat from the old crop and will continue to eat from it until the harvest of the ninth year comes in." God would make available to his people all that they needed, enough and more than enough, if they would just obey him and trust him. They didn't have to depend upon themselves. They didn't have to store ahead. They just had to obey and trust God. God was teaching them this in the strongest and most visible kind of way. In 1 Kings chapter 17 and verses 7 through 24, God worked through Elijah. And then in 2 Kings chapter 4 and verses 1 through 7, God worked through Elisha, in both cases to vividly show that God can be trusted to take just a little and provide all that was needed. Jesus did the same thing when he fed two crowds that numbered in the thousands each one. These events showed God's power to do the miraculous, certainly. But they also showed God's ability to provide his people with enough. Jesus continued this kind of thinking in his teachings in Matthew chapter 6 when he taught how godly people should pray. In verse 11, Jesus said people should say to God, "Give us today our daily bread." Implicit in this is the awareness that we have no promise of tomorrow. If we have what we need today, we have enough. As Jesus continued there in verses 19 through 21 and verses 25 through 30, he emphasized our need to trust God to provide us with enough of what we need for the whole of life. And so he said, "Do not store up treasures for yourselves on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food, and the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns. And yet, your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the lilies of the field grow? They do not labor or spin. Yet, I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and gone tomorrow, thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? What Jesus taught seems, at least on the surface, to be irresponsible, doesn't it? It goes against what we teach our children. It goes against what we try to practice ourselves and give an example to them for. Taking responsibility for ourselves, not depending upon government or any other organization or anything or anyone else to provide and take care of us. It's in conflict with all that we know about personal independence, about personal finances. It's diametrically opposed to our culture. In fact, if you want to look at it this way, it's un-American. Isn't it? Isn't it? Jesus' teaching in these verses, as well as elsewhere, is not just against covetousness and greed or self-sufficiency and worry. It's also against having more than we need. Effectively, Jesus teaches contentment in having enough as God lovingly provides it. However, each of us comes back to the fundamental question, a question that seems to differ for each of us, and that question is, what is enough? What is enough? Can I define enough as I see it and make it a blanket statement that fits all of us and that fits all of Ventura, fits all the world? Probably not. After all, my vision is limited. I see what I think is enough. Your vision will be different and will differ with mine in very profound ways, arguable ways. And people in a totally different culture, in a totally different part of the world, will see enough, again, very differently than either one of us. And so it would go. But we're here. We're living in this culture. We're living in an environment in which enough to the rest of the world is abundance and plenty, at least materially. And so we have to think about what is enough within our culture? What is enough within our families? What is enough within the lifestyle that perhaps our profession is connected to? What is enough when it really comes down to us individually and us as a family? Well, that's a question that we may never have asked ourselves. That's a question that really has to do, it seems, more than anything else with what is the culture at the given point in time. Because then enough becomes relative, doesn't it? I have enough relative to what the culture as a whole says I need to have. Or I don't have enough in relation to what the culture says I need to have. But what about God? And what about what God says I need to have? In God's eyes, in God's wisdom, in God's perspective, what truly is enough? In the 1960s, a simplicity movement gained momentum within this country. And it has roots within Christian theology. Today, it's estimated that 10% of all American adults follow some aspect of what is called simple living. Some people have drastically rethought their needs. Some people have rethought their standards and lowered them because they realized that they had raised their standards to such a level that their life was just the proverbial rat race, and that they were running themselves into the ground to to get and to have all of these things, whatever those things were for them, that they thought they had to have, that somehow somebody had convinced them, directly or indirectly, that they had to have. And they realized they didn't. And some people have found creative ways to lower costs and to live a simpler life. Many years ago, Steve and Annette Economides decided to buy less and to live more simply. As a family of six on a yearly income of $35,000, they never used credit cards. Prayer and patience determine if a need is really a want. Now, you and I know, or at least we think we know, that that family's not living in Ventura, California in 2009. $35,000 a year for six people? Right. We're told that in order to live in Ventura at this point in time, the median income just for survival has to be $75,000 for a household. $35,000? And they survive? Tara Kellum is a wife and mother of three. She has to rely on her husband's yearly income of $22,000 because she has chronic fatigue syndrome. By living simply, her family of five paid off $20,000 in debt in 5 years. You and I know that's not easy. $20,000 in 5 years? Most of us would think we'd be doing well if we paid it off in 20 years. $22,000 a year for a family of five. And then there's the Nicholsons. I hope this story encourages all of us to rethink what the true focus is of our lives. Sean and Cheryl Nicholson save every receipt and track expenses with a spreadsheet. They have to if they want to stay afloat financially. The excess income of former high-paying jobs has vanished, and debt continues to drain their budget. Yet, Sean and Cheryl are financially free. No, they're not free to spend money as they please, but they found a freedom that reaches much deeper than their pocketbook. They've discovered the meaning of having enough. It hasn't always been this way. During the tech boom of the mid-90s, Sean and Cheryl lived in the heart of Silicon Valley. Sean rode the management fast track of a high-tech firm, while Cheryl handled marketing for an upscale retailer. The feeling then was, it's the new gold rush and we're going to get our share, Sean said. The couple married and agreed on one main goal. We wanted to make money and drive good cars, Cheryl said. They bought a home in the good part of town with amenities such as a $5,000 refrigerator and a $1,000 dishwasher, and they lived their version of financial freedom. Buying was easy. If they wanted clothes, they bought them. If they wanted a vacation, they took one. We'd go out to dinner every night, and we're not talking McDonald's, Cheryl said. We'd go to a $60 a night restaurant just because it tasted good. And at one point, we had three cars because we felt like having a new one. Though the two were Christians, church and faith took a back seat. The things that were important to us were making money and having fun, Sean said. It was all about the here and now. It was very selfish. Money management was simple. When checks came in, they spent them. And if there wasn't enough money, there was always another loan. Sean and Cheryl had arrived. We had the cool jobs at the cool companies with the cool house in the cool neighborhood, Sean said. Yet the trappings of success couldn't hide their growing unrest. Something was wrong and there wasn't any peace, Cheryl said. The more they invested in the pursuits of pleasure, the less they invested in their marriage. Relationship intimacy faded. During that period, the couple found a church and joined a small group. Both sensed God's stirrings, but neither was ready for his next plan. On a whim, the couple joined a missions trip to Mexico. For several days, the group visited neighborhoods filled with mud streets, dirt floors, and piles of rubble. It was kind of embarrassing, Cheryl said. Here we were, unhappy in a big house, when their homes were made of pallets and old garage doors. One evening, Sean and Cheryl watched streams of people attend a makeshift church service. Despite the poverty, the minister asked people to give to the church. I saw kids coming with one peso, virtually nothing. But they came because they believed in Jesus, Sean said. You could see the joy they had, even with so little. The couple rode in silence back to the United States. Miles of freeway revealed miles of excess and reflected their own empty lifestyle. Sean's and Cheryl's hearts broke. Within 20 days, they sold their large house and moved into a 1,000-square-foot home. Then, they slowly started selling the things that had gotten them into debt. Over the next year, the couple began volunteering more at church, became small group leaders, and began planning for future mission trips. It felt so good to get the focus off of us, Cheryl said. The dominoes kept falling. Cheryl quit her job and began work at a nonprofit. Eventually, Sean left his job too. God just totally changed our hearts, Sean said. God changed their marriage too. The couple put more emphasis on spending time together, improving communication, and changing their attitude toward money. Once you realize you're managing God's resources, buying stuff means prayer, asking for His direction, and making sure you're diligent in how you spend it, Cheryl said. Plus, the couple has found joy in giving to others, letting go of what they used to hold on to. In short, they're free. Sean said, God changed our hearts from more to, Lord, this is yours. What do you want us to do with it? We're more content. We have everything we need and more. Jesus once said he had no place to lay his head. Essentially, what that means is that Jesus was homeless. Was he complaining? Was he crying about it? Did he feel disenfranchised? Did he feel like his rights had been taken away from him? No. He knew he had enough. When he sent out his 12 apostles and 72 other disciples, he told them not to take along extra money or extra clothes, but to trust God to provide those things as well as housing for them. Again, Jesus is teaching what is, to our minds, irresponsible. You and I, as individuals or as a congregation, would not send out missionaries like that, and missionaries would not go out like that, would they? In contrast, those who Jesus sent out would not have to worry about providing for themselves because they could trust God to provide them each day with what they needed. And what they needed was enough. Back in Matthew chapter 6 and verses 31 through 34, Jesus concluded his teaching by saying, so do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be given you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. These people that Jesus was characterizing in this text were people just like you and me. People who worry about having and providing and getting and having enough tomorrow. People who were worried about being secure of their own doing. Are you more secure in what you can acquire? Or are you more secure in what God, who made everything, can acquire and give to you? Are you living like a pagan, an ungodly person? Or are you living in obedience and trust of God who loves you and sacrificed for you? Are you seeking your temporary kingdom? The kingdom that you'll have during your life on this earth and give up the moment you die? Or are you seeking God's eternal kingdom with riches that cannot be taken away by anything? Won't you seek God's righteousness and trust that He will provide you with enough because He made you, He sustains you, He loves you, and He wants you to be His child forever? If we can help you in any way, we urge you to come forward this morning, right now, as we stand and sing this song.